Hey, this is Brendan Agema, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
How's it going, Ilya?
Hey, it's going pretty well. I am today in the Hot Rod Cameras Burbank showroom. It is a little after hours. It might be slightly echoey because, there's nothing really going on except for me sitting here with our sound equipment display, and I just hooked up my laptop to it and plugged it in, and we're making a podcast.
I think it's a better backdrop than recording inside your theater.
Oh, okay. Well, great.
It showcases what you can get when you go to Hot Rod Cameras.
Well, at least in this corner, there's a ton of lights and lighting equipment and lighting accessories and light type stuff. And in front of me, which you can't see, is a whole bunch of sound equipment. I've got Zoom mixers and Rode microphones and
a snazzy new microphone. I'm still using the very same mic that we've been using since we started this podcast, and you got a fancy new one.
It's just for right now. This is a display thing. This really was a last minute sort of like, I can go set up a bunch of things in the theater. I can go fiddle around, or I can literally just plug in here and voila, here we are. So Brendan Agema is on the show today, and he's got a show called Them.
Them.
Which you did the interview for this.
I did the interview. Fascinating interview, actually. He talks about a lens that I've never heard of. I'm gonna leave it right there because I don't even know how to spell it. But he talks about it, and it's got a very specific bokeh, and it's a fascinating conversation. And if you haven't seen Them, season two is up. It's a completely new cast and story from season one, so you don't need to go back and watch season one. Although we did talk to Checo Varese, who shot season one. And they're both really good, and they're both super scary and atmospheric, and I really enjoyed the season. I think it's especially if you like dark, creepy stories that take place in Los Angeles, but I believe are shot in Atlanta.
Well, I do like dark, creepy stories about Los Angeles, so maybe that'll be great. Yeah,
it's fun.
And now, Close Focus.
Ben, it is time for our Close Focus. What do we have to talk about? What's going on?
Well, there's a lot in the news. Obviously, we're not going to get into news. That's not what we do here. But
we talk
something
about entertainment news.
True. Something that we have been following from the very beginning is the Rust trial. That was the movie, the Western movie, where Alec Baldwin accidentally murdered the cinematographer. I shouldn't say murdered. They accidentally shot the cinematographer, who Helena Hutchins, who died, and it was a huge tragedy and something that I find frustrating because I've been personally speaking out against using blank fire and real guns on sets for a long time. I understand there are people who love them, but anyway, Alec Baldwin went up for his, I believe it was, what was he up for? It was involuntary manslaughter.
Indeed, involuntary manslaughter, yeah.
And his case was dismissed by the court.
It was dismissed with prejudice because of mishandling of evidence, is what I understand. I gotta say, every clip it seems like that I see about this, and it's been on the news for the last couple of days, they keep referring to the gun as a prop gun. It may have been working as a prop gun, but a true prop gun would not be able to fire a bullet.
All prop guns could fire real bullets if you put them in, and what happened here was the armorer brought live actual bullets to the set, and she was found guilty.
There's no difference then between a prop gun and a real gun.
Correct.
So it's just being used as a prop, but it is a real
gun. In the same way that there's not a difference between a prop ham sandwich and a real ham sandwich.
Correct. You're just, one of them is being shot by a camera and the other one is not. So,
yes.
Yeah. They both go into your mouth. They both go into your stomach. That's
correct.
Alec Baldwin still has to face another trial. There's a civil suit against him. So I don't know when that comes to be, but he seems to have escaped criminal prosecution for what happened.
I have never believed that he was criminally liable for this. I believe that the armorer was. And people will say, correctly, he's a producer on the film. But how often do you have a producer, like, you get an actor attached to your film and you give them a producer credit to get them to be in your film? Like, I don't know that he was involved in hiring and firing, and maybe he was. But even if he was, if you're hiring an armorer,
you expect a professional. Yeah,
you certainly don't expect that person to bring actual live bullets, not blanks, bullets to the set and to use it for target practice or whatever in between shots. And if for some reason you were working on a show that required real live bullets, like let's say you were working on Mythbusters, which is a reality show that did a lot of stuff with real live bullets. If you're doing that, then there's an entirely different protocol of safety that goes on around everything. And even though I do think it is negligent on the part of the first AD and on the part of Alec Baldwin to both have checked the chamber of the gun that was being handed to Alec Baldwin, according to what we've been told, he was handed a gun that he was told was cold, meaning there was nothing in it. And in fact, there wasn't a blank, which could have injured and or killed somebody, but that
he was told it was cold. The gun was completely cold, that there was nothing in it.
A blank could injure you, could definitely injure you, might kill you, but it's unlikely to get killed by a blank. But a bullet will, you know, that's we'll what a bullet's, it. Yeah. It's designed to do what it did, you know?
It will be interesting to see what happens next with this.
Yeah, I mean, and again, like I'm not trying to take one side or the other. I just think that the person who was at fault was the armorer, and I don't know if she's actually in jail, but she was found guilty.
That's true. Anything else going on in the world that we need to talk about?
I mean, you know, we lost a few people last week. We lost Shelley Duvall and Richard Simmons. And we lost
Dr. Ruth,
Dr. Ruth Westheimer. Yeah, it was kind of a bummer of a week.
It's interesting. So,
And there was something else you wanted to talk about, apparently, which is about this. I had to look up the reference, the Hawktua girl.
The Hawktua girl.
Do you want to explain what the hell the Hawktua phenomenon is?
Yeah, you know, and I think it brings up sort of a slightly larger sort of story that we can get into too. But essentially, this woman was approached in a TikTok video or an Instagram video. I think it was a TikTok video, and by some influencers who were interviewing people on the street at night. And essentially, the question was about, you know. What is like your go-to sexual move or something like that? And she basically made a reference to spitting while performing oral sex on a man. So this has taken the internet and the interwebs by storm. She now has representation as in an agent. She has registered trademarks for Hawktua. She has been selling t-shirts and hats. I understand she's made some merchandising deals and started a company called 16 Minutes, which I have
very
to say—
Very funny, that's clever.
it's very self-aware, because really, it seems to me like there's this moment in time and she's going to capitalize on it as much as humanly possible. And this kind of comes right on the heels of actually a recent survey, and I want to say it was USA Today, but I can't be 100% sure now. I heard this a few days ago. Recent high school graduates, like class of 2024, recent high school graduates, 2/3 of them said that they either want to be an influencer or consider themselves an influencer now, which has usurped previous aspirations for career goals, including reality TV star and actor, which used to be like, you know, in these top slots. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of people out there who really aspire and want to have the sort of success that Hawktua girl has had. And what I think is very interesting is that unless you have a massive team and money behind you, you can't really manufacture that. There is something that happens that is authentic, that captures the zeitgeist, that captures a moment in time, and then you become internet famous for it. And so all of these people out there who are going to then you know, try to dedicate their lives or say that they're going to do this. And then, of course, you know, certainly a number of these people are going to become accountants and or scientists or all these other things. But, you know, when you're 18 years old and you don't necessarily know what you're going to do with your life, and there's a bunch of, you know, you see people out there living these incredibly lavish lifestyles and getting paid for it, it's pretty seductive. And I don't know really what is going to happen to our industry, which used to be sort of like the number one thing that people wanted to go into. They wanted to go into entertainment. They wanted to go into being an actor. They wanted to go into working in the movies. I had dinner with a friend last night who works for AFI. He does work at AFI. He's a lecturer, as a teacher. And he said he has noticed in the last couple of years that enrollment is getting to be slightly older demographics than before. It's that people who are coming to it are slightly more mature. There's less, you know, sort of like younger crops of people trying to go to AFI. And I've talked to a couple of other people at various educational institutions that where their cinema programs are less impacted. They're less popular than they used to be. Hmm. So I don't know. Maybe there is a little bit of a
maybe
shift
somebody needs to start influencer school somewhere.
I think influencer school might be a thing, but I think there's a lot of other people who just turn on YouTube and voila, there's your influencer school. So.
Yeah, I mean, to this I will say, I have a very good friend who I went to film school with, and he has kids who are now grown. And I remember 15 years ago him telling me that his kids, who then were both, you know, probably between the ages of like 8 and 16, like never watched television, didn't watch movies. They just watched YouTube. All they cared about was YouTube. They had no interest in movies. They had no interest in TV. And his whole angle at the time was like traditional media, legacy media, as we call it, was just going out the window. And it was all going to be replaced by YouTubers and whatnot. This is long before TikTok. This is before Vine. And you know, in the intervening time, we've seen peak TV. You know, I think that there is room for people to want personality-driven, influencer-driven content. But that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's the content is, you know, these people freeballing it in their stupid internet videos, and some of them are great and some of them are terrible. And, you know, and I say, go to it, hawk to a girl. I'm sure she has a name. I don't know her name. I it was like she just came out of the internet fully formed as a meme and a character. And of course, she knows, she's smart enough to know, and everybody knows that unless she shows that she's got a penchant for singing or doing stand-up comedy or acting or something, hosting something. Yeah. This is going to be like, this is going to blow over, no pun intended, in 10 minutes. It'll all be over. And good for her. I'm not trying to break her rice bowl or anyone's rice bowl. But the
I've never
the
heard point, that expression.
My point is, my point is that, you know, like the legacy media, the so-called legacy media, sticks around because I think people like professionally produced shows, movies, and random, you know, man on the street kind of stuff or influencer stuff is engaging but ultimately disposable. And I always ask, and maybe somebody does do this, but do people go back and watch like their favorite episode of Mr. Beast, or is Mr. Beast like, you know, like The Daily Show or like the news or something like that, where it's like
it's ephemeral and gone.
Yeah, meant for right now. We're never coming back to it, you know. And you know, I'm not saying that everything has to be immortal. Things should be of their moment, and some things should be should have a longer shelf life. And you know, that's why you will have a favorite album of music or whatever that you'll revisit, or you know, favorite movie, favorite TV series. You know, people will go back and rewatch these things. People will go back and re-listen to certain podcasts. You know, like Script Notes is a great podcast, because if you're interested in screenwriting, you could go back to episode one and listen to all of them, and they're all pretty much just as relevant. You know, so, you know, again, I'm not here to crap on anyone for trying to make a dollar in the entertainment industry. We're all kind of doing the same thing. And, you know, certainly not like saying that one thing is the high road and one thing is the low road. I don't really believe in that. But I do think that, you know, obviously this person needs to get out from under this moniker as fast as she can and establish herself as something else, like cash in, make a bunch of money, and either stay and show that you do something else than this one joke you made, or take the money and run and go live your life. You know, I mean, she might be able to make hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars off of this one moment where she's the main character on the internet. And usually we say, don't be the main character on the internet. It doesn't seem to me like she's doing anything bad or dangerous or hateful or, you know, that anyone's gonna, you know, be upset about.
I have started seeing memes though that say like, oh, what's the Hokta girl's take on this situation or whatever it is. And it's like, you know, it's pretty funny for that to become, you know, to become a thing and to be happening so quickly. I mean, this is like the last week or so, right? It's like very, very fast. You could not miss it, it seems like. Anyway, so Ben, I think we ought to get to our featured interview now with Brendan Ugama.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Thank you for coming back on the show. I guess we had you on here about 2 years ago for Moonshot.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, yeah. And I think since then, I don't think you had shot Chucky at the time, or you had, but it hadn't been released yet.
Yeah.
And maybe it hadn't been released. I don't know.
No, if I was doing Moonshot, it would have been released. It came out in 2019. Chucky did.
God, it feels
Child's
like
Play. Yeah,
Child's Play. It feels like it just came out. Like, okay.
Yeah. Time flies.
Oh my God, it's so crazy. So let's talk about Them though, because you know, Them is a really amazing show. As a horror aficionado, I feel like I don't hear enough people talking about it. We had for season one, we had Checo Varese on here, and Checo shot a lot of season one, and he's awesome. I think we've had him on the show like four or five times. He's amazing. Firstly, like, what brought you to the show, and when you came to the show? This is something that I don't know anything about. Is there communication with Checo or any of the DPs from season one? Are you trying to create a fresh look so you're not talking to them? What happens when you take the reins of a season two? It's a new story, so it doesn't have to have necessarily direct continuity with look, but obviously there's got to be that conversation.
Yeah. Well, I'll start with the beginning. Like, I agree with you. Checo did an amazing job on season one. I think that show looks phenomenal. And I saw Them just as like a, you know, audience. I watched it when it came out and I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I thought it was so powerful, so well made, brilliant writing, performances, everything, and shot so well. And I was just a fan of the show. And then my agent called me and she said, you know, they're doing Them season two and it's an anthology. Do you want to meet with them? And I said, absolutely. You know, I was 100% interested. And the meetings obviously went well and it worked out. And then when I started getting into the kind of the look of everything, I did reach out to Checo briefly just to kind of say hi more than anything, introduce myself. Mm-hmm. And but we didn't really have conversation about any kind of, you know, look and what lenses and this and that. It wasn't that at all, because A, it is an anthology. It's a different storyline completely. I mean, it was you know, it takes place in 1989 and 1991 rather than what he did, what took place in the 50s or 60s. And there was no real tie, visual tie, to try and bring it in, except for to make sure that it you know, it could honor kind of the quality that they were making in season one. And I took it fresh from there. I took it really fresh from there and had plenty of, it was really like any other show, but a very in-depth conversation with Little Marvin, the creator. Mm-hmm. You know, just trying to figure out exactly what it was, working with the director of the pilot episode was Craig McNeil. And, you know, we just kind of hashed everything out and threw every kind of idea we could at what it should be and feel like and look like and how we would approach shooting it, until we kind of found out what we thought was right.
And, you know, and what was that? So like, what are the kind of the guiding principles when it starts? I think when it starts, it's in 1991 and then it flashes back a little bit. I could swear the first Chiron that comes up says 1991, but when evoking period, I'm always curious about when you're creating the way you're going to evoke period, is it about making a commentary on that period from today, making it feel like a different time? Or is it about rooting us in that time and making that time come to life?
Yeah, I think for us, we did not try and make it feel like we shot it in 1991 or anything. Like, mm-hmm. we didn't use really old lenses for everything and, you know, vintage lenses for that period, from that period for it. And that wasn't necessarily a main focus for us. What we ended up doing was just really talking about what we liked as far as warmth, contrast, yeah. highlights, shadows, what that felt like, what should it feel like. And also a major part for us was a discussion of lensing and where the camera would be in relation to the actors a lot. And yeah. how we would approach that. So what we did for the first block mostly was approach it with like using just two focal lengths. We had a wider focal length that we would do most of our close-ups with, and then we had a slightly longer focal length that we would do for, you know, POVs or something that was a little more, you know, just needed that little extra focal length to it, that little bit longer of a lens. But we really tried to shoot the majority of it on this one focal length that would allow us to place the camera in the right relationship to the actor. So the idea was that we would never like be on a lens, on a camera at the back of the room, getting like a wide and then start lensing up from there. We never mm-hmm. wanted that approach. It was always just move the camera to where it needed to be. We'll approach it on this lens that could see everything. We were shooting large format.
And which camera so were you using?
We were using a mini LF.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, and we were shooting with anamorphic lenses for all of Don's storyline, and for everything to do with Edmund, we were shooting on spherical lenses.
That was one of my questions, because I noticed the even the aspect ratio in the show changes, and you know, you could easily obviously shoot both and size them both up to 16:9, but I noticed kind of the change up here and there.
Right. Well, so we did an aspect ratio change for the episode 7. Episode 7 went to 4:3.
That's where I noticed it. Yeah.
It was drastic. And we wanted that to be a very specific, distinct look that was actually different from the rest of the show.
You know, like sometimes I'll come across these listicles online where they'll talk about how like X movie was all shot on one lens. You know, like they just used a 25 or a 50 or whatever. So you limited yourself, and based on what you're saying, I'm assuming you broke it. You broke this rule if you had to, but you kind of stayed on one or two lenses for most everything. So, and when you say that you had to move the camera rather than just swinging a new lens, for you, what is the creative impetus to do that? What does that get you that swinging a lens wouldn't get you?
I find when you swing a lens from the back of the room or from like your initial setup and you just lens up, I find what you're doing is you're just getting sizes. And you're just getting like close-ups, and you're just and it's really more about the size rather than the feeling that you're going to get from a close-up. Like if you put the camera on 135, and you're here on somebody, you're going to flatten their face out. It's not going to look as great, in my opinion, on them. And it's just kind of it's a simple way of doing it. Whereas if you put the camera up close on say a 35 or 40 mil, now their face looks great. I think you get a lot more dimension in their face. They are close to the lens. You feel every ounce of their performance. The movements are so much more drastic and so much more felt. And I think it just is a better way of telling stories to kind of be personal with the camera. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that you, and then once you start to kind of go down that route, when that's your kind of theory on this one, on that particular project, it really allows you to kind of, I don't know, just think in a much more artistic way. For me, it felt like it was like, what does this shot mean? What does this shot want to feel like for the audience? What's the difference between the camera being right here on a 35 rather than like, you know, 2 inches back on a 35, you know, like these little differences make such a impact. Whereas I think if you're on 135 from further away, you know, those little differences are, you can't really tell as much. They're much more, not very influential. on the story.
My next question about that is, like, what's the cost of that? So, you know, I think it's a pretty typical thing, and we've all been on sets where it's like, let's just swing a new lens, and, you know, we don't have to move anything, we don't have to relight anything. What does it cost you to do that? Is it literally just the time of picking up the camera and walking it over to where you need it? Or is it usually like a bigger relight, or, you know, like, and is that a thing you have to factor into your plan when you're planning out your days?
Yeah, I think the biggest fear is that it's a little more time, whereas it doesn't have to be, you know, if you are moving the camera in and you're relighting every time, of course that's going to take more time, but I don't try to do that. But if you're just moving the camera and moving it in 10 feet or whatever, then that shouldn't take too long. And that is a much, you know, to me, it works a lot better that way. You do factor it in. And I think once you get into that rhythm, it works well. And everyone kind of accepts and understands what the timing is going to be. I think the biggest factor, though, is really when you're working with directors or ADs, is them wrapping their head around it, because everyone's so used to making it a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, what do you mean we're only gonna do this with one camera most of the time? We're just gonna move it every single time we want a different size, rather than just like flipping a lens.
Yeah.
You know, that's,
I mean, in a way, I mean, changing a lens isn't instantaneous either. They're not on a turret. You have to bring it in, you go to the box, bring it in, take the other one off, house it, blah blah blah. I mean, I don't know that it necessarily takes that much longer to pick up the camera and move it. It just means somebody's got to pick the camera up and move it than anything.
It doesn't, because when you cut to swing a lens, I mean, you know, the actor steps off for a minute, they do last looks, all this stuff happens, and, you know, it's 5 minutes every time anyways. So
for you, are these the lenses that you just have an affinity for in general, or do you think that they were like specifically chosen for this project?
I think they were, I mean, I have an affinity. I like the focal length that we used, which was like a 40 mil and a 75. And I think those focal lengths worked really well for me. But when it came to finding what lenses it would be for this project in particular, it was really, you know, understanding what that would do for us impact wise and shooting wise, and how, you know, what our sets were like, and how much space we could get, and, you know, relationships with the actors and what lenses look great on the actors. So we did some early testing and looked at, you know, these focal lengths on our main actors and kind of came to conclusions based on all of that. But it wasn't like this lens from this set is the lens that I use all the time, because what we did is, you know, we used the Cook anamorphic full frame for the Dawn storyline, and for the Edmund, it was the Angino Primes, which I had never actually used before. And we found these ones for a few reasons that we kind of chose them, but they were, you know, they were pretty nice. And then what we ended up doing later on in the season, like especially for episode 7, which we'll get into, was we switched that all up. Like, it actually changed quite a bit by that point. And we had a whole new set of lenses and everything was kind of mixed match. But at the beginning, it was really strict to just those two.
Since you didn't shoot every episode, like, did you set this rule in place, and like, did the other DPs who followed you, did they adhere to that rule? Did they move the camera and stick to just those lenses, or did they pull out the other lenses?
I think so. Evans Brown shot the other three episodes and he did an amazing job. I think that they switched lenses up a little bit more. They did move the camera a lot, and he was very specific about that, but I don't think they stuck to just the focal lengths as much. And I think it was really a director thing when he got into it with his first director that was having a hard time understanding or wanting to do that, I should say. So I believe at that point they kind of started to kind of go down a different route a little bit, which opened it up later on, and why we decided later that we would also evolve in for episode 7 and kind of do something different.
Yeah, I mean, the show really evolves, because I feel like, you know, the first few episodes have a great look to them, but episode 7 is just so striking. I mean, like, it's striking, beautiful, and bold, and, you know, like, it's the kind of stuff you can't dial back in post. You are clearly making some strong decisions on set. So, we don't want to horribly spoil it for everyone, but I would highly recommend anyone check it out. It's on Amazon Prime if you have it. What were the decisions that went into Seven? Because Seven is, again, just such a striking, amazing, you know, expressionistic, I would say. I'm always interested to know what art movement people want. Like, one time I was talking to an executive producer and I said, like, expressionism, and they were like, no, it's magical realism. And I'm like, cool, whatever. But like, what was there an artistic influence, or what how did you create that look for that amazing episode?
Yeah, I mean, episode Seven, the cool thing about Seven is that our showrunner Little Marvin directed it, and it was his first episode of anything he directed.
Really? And he hadn't directed any other episodes up to then?
No.
Oh, wow.
And he knew he was going to direct. He came up to me like within the first week or two and it was like, I'm going to direct episode Seven. This one is going to be the last episode we do because we're going to shoot out of order at the end. And I want it to be something that's different from the rest of the series. I want it to feel like it's, these characters are locked in their house for the most part. I want it to feel very claustrophobic, and I want it to have its own entity. And let's talk about how we can come up with ideas to make it feel different and to make it feel claustrophobic and so on and so forth. And that was like, yeah, 2-3 weeks into the production. And this came at the end, you know, 3 months later. So we had a lot of time just talking about it between episodes and, you know, just kind of coming up with ideas. All the scripts had been written, so we knew what it was. And it was a long process of just like reading the script and talking about it and thinking of ideas and hashing it out. And it came down to this. There's a few things that kind of really helped kind of define the look, I think. One was we went with a aspect ratio of, 4 by 3. Yeah. And it was something that we talked about early on, and it was part of it came from the conversation of trying to make it feel more claustrophobic, trying to do these close-ups of people where you didn't have all this space around them. And we were shooting 2-4-0 for everything else. So it's like, well, no matter what, even if you're in here, there's all this space to the side. So we come up with the concept.
I kept thinking when I was watching about all those scenes in that room with all those TVs, and I was like, are we trying to make it look like we're one of those scenes, or, you know, like they're old school 4x3 TVs? That was where my mind went when I was watching it.
That's interesting. That's fun. No, I mean, that was never really a conversation. It was more really just trying to give it this own entity and to play into the idea that we could do that. We wanted to do these close-ups where, you know, there's a lot of direct address into the camera, like actors, eyelines right down the lens.
Had me thinking of like that, Tak Fujimoto and Silence of the Lambs. Like totally. I love
which
that
we talked part. About. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you?
We talked about. I mean, we never tried to like steal anything and say like it's this, but we had. We would watch movies or just like reference films all the time, and it was a lot to do with either that Wong Kar Wai. Obviously, we would talk about Barry Jenkins and his work with the direct address as well, and different things. And we would just be like, "Yeah, this is, you know, we love this, we love that," and you know, just kind of getting onto the same page artistically is what we were, what influences we liked. But yeah, so it all came from there, and then there was this early discussion in the series that we wanted it to be like, Lil Marvin really wanted it to be Los Angeles in the rain. Like, he wanted this like overall rainy period over the whole season. But of course, we were shooting in Atlanta in the summertime. That was going to be a massive thing.
You're shooting Atlanta for LA.
We were shooting Atlanta for LA.
That's sad. I kept looking at locations and being like, where is that exactly? I'm not exactly like, that doesn't look like an LA apartment complex. Oh, well, you know.
Yeah. You know, so we scrapped the idea of the rain pretty early. But when we started prepping episode Seven, I remember like just, you know, suggesting like we wanted to do rain early in the season. This episode takes place mostly indoors. Maybe we can make it feel like they're kind of locked in on a rainy day. You know, and we could just play rain out the windows all the time. And so we did that. And that kind of helped dictate the look to be this cool, overall cool feel in the house, where it was this kind of cold, kind of bluer tone rather than the rest of the series, which had a much more of a warm hue to it. Except for, of course, the harsh, drastic reds, the color of threat that we kind of interlaced throughout the whole series, the whole episode, through even wardrobe and like the soup and the washing machine.
The soup shot specifically, and that was like another motif that I saw crop up in episode 7, which was these like straight down orthographic shots that I hadn't seen prepondering in any of the previous episodes. So I guess it makes sense, but it was like, and you were even doing like match cuts, which obviously you're not the editor, but like, you know, you're setting up the editor to do match cuts from like a straight down shot of a bowl to a straight down shot of other things similarly shaped.
Oh yeah. I mean, that shot in particular took a lot more planning and effort and building than you could ever imagine for something like that, because that washing machine, you know, we built specifically so we could get cameras below it looking through bloody water. And then we flip it around, we do the over top looking down, and we had to get a playback person in so we could record it and then overlap it when we did the soup in the next shot, to kind of, which we did like a days later, and we had to match the perfect, circle. And so we made sure that everything was round and had the kind of right idea. We could get the blood to be the same color, which we had to, you know, enhance a little bit in post to make it extra red so that it would match cut into the red soup a bit better. But, you know, that was fun. Like, that was, this episode to me was one of the most free artistic kind of episodes I've done of any kind of series, because every day and every discussion throughout prep and production with Lil Marvin was creatively based. How do we make this like interesting, telling the story, but in a creative and you know, different, fun way? Like, how can we evolve?
Did you stick to the lens rule, or did you break the lens rule? You said
no. So episode 7 was completely different. We tested a lot of different lenses again before we started production on that episode, and we picked a handful of different lenses. I think we had Petzval lenses, Master Builds, we had Canon FDs, we had a few others. And what we did is we carried all this type of glass, and whenever we wanted a certain look, we would put that lens on that we thought it would work best for. We ended up shooting, I'd say, more than half the episode on a Petzval. You know, once we started kind of working with the Petzvals, we were just like, this feels right for this episode.
I'm not familiar with that lens. Like, what are the qualities of it?
They have a very distinct bokeh that is swirly, and
I know the shots you're talking about now.
I think I do.
You probably do. Yeah, like I want to say your sound designer underscored like the removal or something of it. Like, it felt very emphasized.
It did, and he did. You're right, the sound designer did, because there were like, we specifically set up shots of, say, for example, of Pam Grier coming down the stairs into the basement, and then we placed these lights that are just bare bulbs throughout the basement set. And the idea was that we understood that there was going to be this flare from this lens that would kind of be very drastic and see, and you could see this big ring of light from the flare. And we knew, we were talking about it for different things, like the sound design can play into this. If we do the tracking shot that goes over top of all the lights where she carries the clothing to the washer, and we're going over the beams. And we knew that the sound design could be, you know, when you pass by the lights, you get that little boom of flare of light, that the sound design would kind of help emphasize that. So it was it was fun. It was great to be able to think that way and make it work. Yeah, the Petzvals became kind of the lens of the episode for sure.
What was the artistic impetus behind using the various lenses and, you know, like behind the overall kind of style change of episode 7?
I mean, we wanted it to feel different and not like the rest of the episodes. We wanted to get rid of those lenses. That was kind of a place to start, you know, the lenses that we had previously been using. So we tested a bunch, and it really came down to liking certain focal lengths for certain things. And we were just like, well, let's just carry them all. We could, you know, carry those 3 or 4 sets of lenses for this last 2 weeks of the production. It just came from a desire to want to switch things up and keep it kind of this like mixed bag look of things where it wasn't so perfect or uniform, you know, and we could allow it to be a little more free and kind of messy in a way.
this maybe is a weird comparison, but like I remember we've had on the show a few times Shalotta Bruce Christensen, and she shot Molly's Game, which was Aaron Sorkin's first directing experience, period. And I was shocked at that because the guy created, you know, whatever, three or four TV series before he did that. He never directed one of them. So working with Little Marvin as a first-time director, was he a first-time director or just a first-time episodic director on that? Or had he
directed? First-time director, yeah.
So
not directed.
So, I mean, I'm assuming he was in the Video Village and he was seeing how things were handled up until then. But, you know, like, what were the challenges for you in terms of like, you know, helping him to create his first time directing experience? I'm not obviously digging for any dirt, but I'm just curious, like when someone gets behind the camera for the first time, you know, like what were the things that, you know, where you came in the most handy, I guess.
You know, I gotta be honest, I didn't have that experience. I know what you're wondering, but like the weird thing was Little Marvin, he knows the stories inside and out.
Yeah.
And he understood, and he went through the edits of season one, so he understood what pieces would go to what and how to kind of cut things together. He was brilliant. Like, he was one of my favorite directors I've ever worked with, by far. Like, he understood the whole process, and he didn't push where he didn't, you know, and it was a very collaborative thing, and he is, you know, he would, you know, get support from the people he needed, like, you know, myself and the operators and the production designer and everybody else to like where, you know, to help him where he did. But he was never someone who was lost in any way. He was never someone who didn't have an idea of how to approach it. And to be completely honest, he was probably, his approach to everything was so creative that it probably elevated the creativity of everybody.
Oh, that's great. Set. That's great to hear.
Yeah. It was a great experience. You know, that's the type of like working with a director experience that I would love to carry through on everything.
I mean, like, can you then kind of drill down? Because I used to even ask people like when we first started the podcast, like if you could build a director in a laboratory who would work well with cinematographers, what would you do? But I'm not asking you to tell directors what to do. But if you could say like, what were the aspects of the collaboration that you found most exciting, most satisfying, most fruitful? All that stuff, like what is it about that experience that made it so positive for you?
I think it was, you know, a huge part of it was the overall excitement to make something great. It was the overall excitement to like push boundaries and not do formulaic television of any kind. It was the collaborative aspect of working together and hashing ideas out,
mm-hmm.
talking about it, being like, you know, what's the best idea, throw ideas around, and being completely free at it. You know, like there was no answer, no idea that was too far-fetched or too wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this like, you know, prep process for so long, like soft, you know, prep throughout the other episodes for so long. And then once we got into actually the episode prep for that, we had gone through so much already and figured out so many things that last period, we just went through the script again and again and again, talked about new ideas. And when a new idea would come in, he would write it in, you know, and we would just sit in his office and throw random concepts around. So it was really just like having something that was really free, you know, and I think like there was no concern of trying to do it in a way that, you know, we've done it before or anything like that, where, you know, it's not relying on instincts of what we've done in the past. It's let's figure out new ways to do it. And that, I think, was what made it so exciting all the time.
If you're doing an episodic series, you don't want every day to be nonstop problem solving and headaches, but you do want like, you know, that kind of collaboration and stuff. So I feel like a lot of TV shows obviously kind of fall into a formulaic way of shooting. And no one, I don't think anyone could accuse any episode of this of being shot in a formulaic way. Like it all has kind of a standalone, it's got its own look and style, which is really awesome.
Yeah.
And even, you know, like whatever post-process you did to kind of create that look too, I thought was also pretty amazing. That episode 7 to me is almost like just a standalone, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, it really did make me think about, you know, German expressionism and stuff like that. Like, it felt like there were a lot of different ideas kind of floating around in there. And yeah. Just the way you used the color, like it felt like you could trace a bunch of artistic movements and stuff that were kind of being played with in there to kind of keep us as an audience off of our, you know, like to keep me leaning forward in my seat. So,
right. Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, like, you know, the color idea was fun as well, because, like I was saying, red was our kind of theme. And it was, even though it was a cool episode for the most part in the house during the day, you would get these little hints of red. And it was really to deal with the scare, the character, the scare. And this was the first episode where we see his face properly.
Yeah.
And I guess
we see it pretty close up too.
But you really see it, you know, that first shot where we push him under the stairs and we reveal him under the stairs.
Yeah.
Just looking in a close up. And that was like, you know, so we started now really getting into all this red kind of theme. And once we started getting into kind of these, like, you know, visions or of Cal when he's sleeping, and then the scare comes in, crawls along the bed or along the ground and over top of the bed and
super creepy,
leans down into his ear. Like, that was so fun to do. And that was like, you know, this is where we're going to push red. And then once we got into the exterior of the toy shop at night, we started bringing out all those red flares to kind of help, and then we started adding red light.
Yeah, when I saw the red flares, I was like, you know, like, I mean, obviously you guys are playing with red, but it was like, even that, I was like, it was just a great little touch, you know?
Yeah. And that was like, you know, but that was it. And it was also one of those, like, this is where the conversations get really creative and really fun. And it was, I remember we were setting that up, and we had this light box over top of the intersection, and we had lights in different areas, and we had red from the toy store itself and all the neons. We had red flares, we had red cop lights, and little Marvin's like, man, it would be cool if it was even more red. So we started like, and I was like, okay, so that's when we, you know, we switched our moon box into like, cause they were all LED. So we switched them into red, and we took these, I started adding red lights behind all the cop cars and uplighting things, like, so just really going heavy with the red. And once we started looking at that, we're like, oh yeah, now it feels like this hellscape that that Dawn's driving to. And now she has to weave through all these police officers and all this chaos of hell to go find her mother's decapitated head. You know, and it kind of just laid into this whole idea that she's just going to the worst place in the world. You know, this hell, you know, it's hell. It's the last thing she wants to ever, anyone would ever want to experience. So, you know, bumping up the red to that intensity was exactly what it called for.
That sounds awesome. Are there any other things about the series you want to mention before we go?
In episode 2, there's a scene where there's a long foot chase.
Yeah.
Where Dawn spots a guy, runs after him down that apartment complex. And the way that the shot evolves is, you know, she runs in after him and it goes through all these apartment doors. And it's kind of this like mouse chase through apartment to apartment to apartment.
Super upstairs, super suspenseful scene. Cause like anyone could be behind any of those doors. And you've set LA up in that series to be kind of a dangerous place. So.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you don't see a cut from the time that she enters until after she's tossed down these stairs, and we kind of reveal all these people that are around the apartment complex throwing bottles at her, and the camera goes up to the sky, comes back down, and then she runs and enters another apartment. So it's this one, it looks like a oneer, but it's, you know, we have two edits in there.
Whenever I see any sequence like that, I'm like, oh, every time the camera whips, there's a cut.
Well, it wasn't every time. We did it twice. So we had one whip cut. So the way that it worked was the edits were built based on limitations of the set. Mm-hmm. When we couldn't get the set any further, we had to cut. So she runs in, she goes through a bunch of apartments, she goes outside, up staircase, back into another apartment. And that was all one take. And where the first cut happens is right when she's in this apartment. There's a guy who flips on a light and he's in his underwear. This big dude's in his underwear and chases her. and she runs out into the next apartment. That's the first cut on the whip. Then the second cut, what happens is she goes out the door onto the staircase. She gets thrown down the stairs. We do this really cool kind of camera handoff to another operator who's on a crane that's been driven, and then passes the camera back to the first operator, and the camera goes up to the sky, and that's where the second cut was, is in the sky. So what we did is when the camera starts inside of that apartment and it starts on Deborah, the actor, it follows her, and then it pans over to the door, and you can see the guy that she's chasing, Curtis, jump over a handrail.
Yeah.
At that time, behind camera, the stunt girl, the stunt actor, comes in and follows our camera onto the railing. And now she, the stunt girl, steps into the over. So it's still the same take. We're now over the stunt girl's back.
Not even a Texas switch, just in the same shot.
In that shot. And then the camera starts to go down the stairs, and Spencer, a camera operator, passes off the camera to the other operator who was on the crane leaning over the stairs to pick it up. And Spencer clears. And now the camera starts to pull back down the stairs as the stunt person gets pushed down the stairs towards the lens and starts, you know, coming towards us. When she crashes to the ground, that's obviously still the stunt actor. The camera then tilts up to the sky. And the idea is that it tilts up and it reveals all the people throwing bottles at her from apartment windows and on the rooftop. And the camera pans through the sky, and that's where the first or the next cut is, right there. Because then by the time we come back down, we tilt back down the building, come back around to her, and now we have Deborah in there. Those are the kind of fun shots that, you know, when we came up with that, that was like a really fun way to do something. And we were initially in prep trying to, when we first started prepping that, it was going to be like a regular sequence with multiple cuts here and there. No idea trying to do as this long one, or until we wanted to kind of push that boundary and see what we could get away with, how far we could push it. And it came down to us finding a location that would allow us to build doorways through apartment buildings and just link all these buildings. So we found that that complex has like a you know, it wasn't a full occupancy, and there was a rundown building, and some of those units were like just garbage on the inside. Like, you know, like the walls had come down and they had filled it up with debris and stuff like that. So the production designer and his art team went in and had to kind of figure out how to like make them all look natural and build these linking units, make this little bit of a maze. So it was a lot of, you know, that was a good collaborative effort from everybody to make it happen.
You know what I appreciate about everything you're saying is you make this show sound like the most fun to make. And I'm sure it's a lot of work and a lot of long days, but I always like to appreciate when people clearly have a lot of fun and creative satisfaction in pulling off some of the challenging or creative or whatever it is. Like I think that we focus on the work so much, and it's easy when you're on the set on the day to feel like you're under the time crunch and you're behind, you know, when you need to have stuff done. And it's just amazing to hear how much fun this all sounds like. Like this,
yeah,
just your description of that sequence sounds like fun to conceptualize and create and execute. It just it's really awesome.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Well, real quick. So before we go, again, the show is Them. It's season two. It's on Amazon Prime. So I recommend anyone listening to the sound of my voice, check it out. It looks great. It's got great performances. It's super scary and creepy, and it's an awesome piece of work. So, but before we go, is there any place? I'm sure you said this last time we were on, but is there any place people can find you online or interact with your work or social media, whatever you got?
Social media. Yeah, I mean, I'm on Instagram. And that's pretty much it for social media. But yeah, you can find me there. And I post a lot of, pictures of stills from work and behind the scenes and things like that. So check me out there.
Well, excellent. Excellent, Brandon. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. Can't wait to have you back on.
Yeah, thank you.
Brandon Ugama, thank you so much for coming on the show. We've had him on before. He's awesome. I love Them. I think everybody should go check it out.
Awesome.
And now, Short Ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's a time when we talk about our pet obsessions. What are you about this week? Is there something that you are really into?
Well, I want to bring up the number two movie at the box office. It was a little movie called Long Legs. And it's, I believe, the biggest hit that Neon has ever released.
Okay.
And I went to see it, and I liked it. I think it's good. But I wanted to underscore the DP, whose name is Andres Arochi, or Arochi. I hope I'm not butchering your name, who does just a heroic, phenomenal, amazing job. This movie looks incredible, and it's so stylish and so brilliant. And this was his first feature as DP.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I know that you don't run out to see every horror movie the same way that I do. I've been hearing about Long Legs for months, and I couldn't wait to see it. And so I went and saw it last weekend, and I was like, who shot, you know, I'm kind of used to this now. Like I look up a movie on IMDb or whatever, or I even just look at the movie poster and my eyes scan right to where the cinematographer is. And I mean, I feel like I should mention it was directed by Oz Perkins, who also, you know, who, from whom all the creative, you know, inspiration comes from. And it really is just a great looking movie with great acting. And it's gotten compared.
Nicolas Cage, right?
Yes. Nicolas Cage. And yeah. He's probably the biggest star in it. Blair Underwood's in it. Alicia Witt is in it. I've tried to find out what the budget is, and the internet has told me it was $10 million. And it made $20 million on its opening weekend, so it doubled its budget, which is pretty freaking impressive. But I think it's a movie people are going to be referencing for a long time. And, you know, maybe we can get Andres on the show. I don't know. I was just really impressed with his work, and looking forward to seeing whatever he does next.
That sounds awesome. I think we can possibly make that happen. We can put our crack producer on the task, and we'll see if we can get Andres on the show.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, no, he was really great. And, you know, it's like whenever I talk to people about this kind of thing, it's like I like to remind them that Eric Messerschmidt, also his first feature as cinematographer was Mank, which won Best Cinematography. Didn't win Best Picture, but won Best Cinematography. So
that's a pretty high bar. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and obviously Eric Messerschmidt had shot for Fincher and had shot lots of big TV stuff before.
Been a gaffer for a very long time.
But, you know, I mean, I guess nothing changes in that, like, a lot of the great cinematographers that we see coming out come out of doing genre stuff. So I look forward to whatever Andres does, whether it's more horror, whatever. I just think he's got a great style to him.
Awesome.
All right. So, Ilya, what is your short end?
I've never done a short end before about music. And I know music does not exactly come into this show or conversation very often, unless it's involving a score or soundtrack or a thank you to Kay Zalatrachi. But, you know, I travel a lot. So I travel every month pretty regularly. I'm back in Los Angeles, and I walk a lot. So I do a lot of like walking and hiking and stuff like that. So I bring some headphones with me, and I'm always listening to, you know, podcasts or books on MP3 and music. And I stumbled across, and as the younger generations would say, I guess I was sleeping on this band called Idles. IDLES is in, like, you know, idle or idle hands. And it's a punk band, or really a post-punk band, formed in Bristol in the United Kingdom. And holy crap, have I just been obsessing about this the entire time. I go on walks, I listen to it. It's in my car, I'm listening to it. So I don't know where they've been, but they've got a, you know, sort of a thick broke, and they've got a really I want to say, like, driving sort of like quasi-punk hardcore sound, and they add in like bits of sort of like post-punk electric type type of effects and things. And Idols, yeah, you know, I don't know if maybe Michael wants to play a little clip of a song that's probably out on like Instagram or something like that, but he could put something in the background here if you want a little flavor of it. But if you're into punk and ska or punk and stuff like I am, give Idols a try. I found them on Spotify, and I would just select like the Idols radio playlist, whatever it is, and listen to a couple of tracks and see if that's you. Holy crap, I was not expecting it. And you know, they get about a million and a half downloads a month, so it's like they're kind of known, they're out there, but it's not Beyonce. This is not like, you know, major you know, major label stuff. So yeah, but I'm really enjoying it, and so I feel like I might as well give them a shout out here for what it's worth, for all the, you know, the punk rockers who are watching the Cinematography Podcast, which I got to imagine there's at least one.
I have to admit, I am also a big fan of the Idols.
Oh really?
I found them back in like December, and I think it was Apple Music. Like it had suggested it, and you know, I'm a very stuck in my ways kind of person, and I like what I like, and like the song came on, and I'm like, what the hell is this? And the next week I was like listening to all their albums. I think they're great.
They have five albums, including one that just came out recently, and yeah, it's a great sound. It's sort of like a classic sound. It's sort of like a modern sound. And I appreciate that there's sort of like remnants of like the Clash and remnants of like more modern sorts of punk sounds in there. So it's really good. Idols, yeah. If you're looking to hear some new music, if your taste is not necessarily always towards the mainstream, give it a shot. You might enjoy it. Try the Spotify playlist. Quite good.
Excellent.
So Ben, that is just about going to do it for this week. Where can people find you if they want to find you outside of this show?
You can find me at benrock.com, and you can find all my social media links and all that good stuff right there. Check out my reel, look at my socials, read my biography.
Yeah, read that Ben Rock bio. Yeah,
yeah. Who doesn't like writing their own bio? Me, I don't care for it, but I had to do it anyway. So, Ilya, where can people find you?
They can find me here, Hot Rod Cameras. Hot Rod Cameras Burbank, Hot Rod Cameras Portland. Next week, we're going to start up some semi-regular hours up there. So yeah, we're going to get things going. So you can find me.
Are you going to set up a podcast set up like what you have here at the Portland branch?
I probably should. I'm going to do that. Yes, you've convinced me just now. It sounds like a really good idea. I'm going to do it. I'm going to set it up.
And I'm going to say, we should actually, when we record podcasts at Hot Rod Cameras, when we do it live with someone, we should do it right where you're doing it right now. I mean, I guess if we're doing it in the middle of a work day, that's hard. But
can't do it in the middle of a work day unless it's in the theater, probably, because there's just too much activity and too much, you know, phone calls and everything else. But if we're doing it after hours, like now, yeah, for sure. It's not too echoey. Sounds all right?
It sounds great.
Okay, good. All right, then fantastic. We'll definitely plan on it. Ben, who do we have to thank to, you know, who made this show possible?
Well, firstly, Alana Cody, our producer, our intrepid producer, who has us both doing, I'm going to be mysterious, one of the most intriguing interviews I think we've ever done. One of the most surprising. I was very surprised to get the call about this particular interview, and it's a cinematographer of a film that looks amazing, but it was Agreed. Not what I was expecting.
Yeah, and it's tomorrow morning, so we're gonna, by the time that people see this episode or listen to this episode, it will already be done.
Who's our new editor's name? What's our new editor's name?
Michael Dispenza. Michael Dispenza is our new editor, and he is going to be chopping this together, and it should be out on Wednesday.
Hi, Michael. I think we've met, and I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Dispenza. Yeah, that's it.
And of course, like every time, we got to thank Kay's Alatrakshi, who produced every scrap of music that you've heard on the podcast. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Hire him to score your next project. He's awesome.
As you should. Absolutely.
So, Ilya, you want to take us out?
Until next time.
Whew.
How was that?
It was very Velveeta-y.
Oh, man. I really tried that time. I really thought, you know, until next time.
It was good. No.
That's a wrap. That's a wrap.
That's a wrap. I don't know, man. We got to work on it. Maybe we can crowdsource this.
Yes, we need to crowdsource our. We need to get some suggestions on how do we end the show, rather than just like awkwardly trailing off and saying I'm going to hit cut.
All right, I'm going to hit cut.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.